I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about innovative initiatives to improve food access in central Indiana. My guests are Lauren Day with Indigo, Shelley Suttles, Food and Public Policy Program Coordinator with the City of Indianapolis, and Rebecca James with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Indianapolis. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about some innovative approaches and initiatives to improving food access here in central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Lauren Day with Indigo, Shelley Suttles, Food and Policy Program Coordinator with the City of Indianapolis, and Rebecca James with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Indianapolis. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. I think probably we have done a fair number of shows about food deserts, food insecurity, food access. And if I've learned anything from it, it is that you each time you need to start the conversation at the beginning and make sure that people understand. So, Shelley, I'm going to start with you. I think you've actually taken part in a couple of those conversations. So I apologize for asking you to tread over familiar ground again, but we ought to talk about why this is an issue and why it is a concern.
Yeah, so I would say, it's definitely important to be mindful of this and put this in the context and make sure we're all speaking the same language. And fortunately, we've actually had an update for you in terms of mapping food access. So we have the POLA Center here in Indianapolis, and Unai Miguel Andres with the POLA Center actually created Indianapolis's very own metric or measure of mapping food access. And Unai is a GIS geographer, and so he created a very unique measure that actually allows us to know that geographic route that a family would have to travel to get to the grocery store. So not just that circular radius of a half mile to 1 mile, but Unai is actually mapping it through infrastructure routes, so paved roads and things like that. And so according to his new measure that he released earlier this year, about 200,000 Indianapolis residents are affected by food access.
200,000, and that by that we mean that they don't have easy access to get
The USDA,
nutritional meals. It's not just there's a convenience store down the block.
Yeah, so just to give a little bit more clarity about that, we do identify full-service grocery stores, so grocery stores that have, a dairy section, fresh fruit and vegetable, whole grains, things of that nature. But we also include the definition of low-income households. So when we think about food access, we're not just thinking about, you may live in a very nice part of a neighborhood and there are no grocery stores and, a certain radius of Meridian Kessler, but we're actually including income. So we're focusing on individuals and communities that have low income and low access.
Okay. Lauren, I am guessing that the infrastructure transportation piece of this is where you come in, right?
Yes, absolutely. My ears perked up.
Okay. So why don't you talk about the place where you integrate with
absolutely.
This?
So we worked with Shelley when we came up with this idea for food in transit. MARTA in Atlanta actually did this in 2015, and I read an article about co-locating fresh produce at major transit stops as a means of reducing that barrier when you think about moving about your city. And, I think that's we have to think about not only where it's located, but the time it takes to get to the fresh food. And if you are looking at our transit population, it's often a lot of the same. That Venn diagram, there's a crossover, too, of those individuals who are either low income or living away from fresh produce. So with our transit center downtown, seeing 60 to 70% of the trips every day, it made sense, if we could, to find a partner to have fresh produce there to potentially reduce one of those trips that they needed. To Shelley's point about the infrastructure, you know, how much is that time that you need out of your day to reach the food, let alone afford it, is certainly a barrier.
So tell me about how this works then.
It's pretty simple. So we work closely with Growing Places Indy. They provide all of the fresh produce, which is wonderful. And so we set up a farm stand every Friday for 3 hours. It's during one of our busiest times of day for transit ridership. Everything is bundled and very low, kind of easy to move about. So bundles you could grab with your hands, for instance. You don't even need a bag. And everything's priced between $1 and $3. And we accept cash, credit, and EBT there. And we always have Growing Places with us. So they're helping answer some of the questions about if it, you know, food item looks unfamiliar or somebody has a request for something, making sure that we're hearing those.
Okay. Rebecca, I'm assuming part of the reason you're interested in this is that this issue affects an awful lot of the people that you serve.
Yes, absolutely it does. In the summer, currently, we're seeing over 900 kids a day in our programs, and we are operating out of 5 summer locations, and our kids do come to us very hungry. And especially at breakfast time, it's not unusual for us to see items that we would never even think of being part of a breakfast or a nutritious meal. So we play a very important role in just the daily nutritional content for the young people we serve and their families in general, and then their neighborhoods at large as well.
What? How many kids total are we talking about here, would you say?
So in the summer, as well as the school year, it's about 900 plus. We can easily get well over 1,000 a day that we're serving. And then collectively, over the course of a full program year, we reach near about 6,000 kids.
And it sounds like, from what you're saying, it's not just that they're not always getting the right kinds of food. It is that often they're not getting any food at all.
Yes, that is true. So, we all live very busy lives, and the families we are serving are those that need us the most. And getting to us can be enough in itself, and coming hungry is just part of that process. It's our role to make sure that they're fed. So we're providing breakfast, lunch, afternoon snack, as well as dinner when they're in our care for a full day.
So, and what sorts of food are you serving them?
So all of our meals are actually balanced and have to meet meal pattern requirements that are established by the USDA. We participate through the Indiana Department of Education Summer Food Service Program. And then we also partner with Second Helpings, and this ensures that they get protein, grain, fruit, vegetable, dairy, the right equivalencies that they are required to have for their age. And that, again, is all determined by the USDA.
We are talking about some new and innovative ways to improve food access in central Indiana here today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Shelley, talk to me more about this map and how it's going to change the way the city, you know, deals with this challenge, because, as I say, I've lost track of the number of shows we have done over the past 9 years on food access, food insecurity, and I know it's a problem where it's really, really hard to move the needle.
Yeah, so we are so appreciative in the city about this new map, because it's actually updated in much more real time than USDA's map. So USDA actually does a food access research atlas on a national level. But Polis Center being able to do it locally provides us this regular update based on the health department's food licensure data and knowing which grocery stores exist. So we have grocery stores open, grocery stores closed with frequency over the year. So this map really gives us that up-to-date information we need to target these creative opportunities we want to bring to the city.
How will it change, though, the policy component for you? I mean, you've got more information. What are you going to do with it?
Yeah, so I would say in terms of the infrastructure around transportation, it lets us be mindful that, you know, based on that old style circular radius, maybe we need to be more mindful that although there are large apartment complexes, it may not be as easy as we would think if we were just thinking about a circular radius. And we need to really reach out to our transportation partners like Indigo and Lyft to provide this public transportation or private rideshare for families.
Okay. This approach, Lauren, that you've got of, in effect, instead of forcing people to go to the food, bringing the food to the people. You know, right now it sounds like it's fairly limited. It's 3 hours a week, right? And it's in one location. Are there plans to expand it? And, you know, I'll tell you what, before we get to that question, what has the response been to this so far?
So we opened last year. I think we were open from August to October. So we had 3 months and we had about 200 unique shoppers. So we are collecting demographic data from them because we applied for and received a CDBG grant to assist with some of the funding, staff time and materials for growing places. So we're collecting demographic information, especially median household income, to, you know, be able to substantiate that investment from HUD. So we had about 200 unique shoppers, but we had many of them were regular shoppers. So green tomatoes always comes to mind. We've already been asked this year when they're going to be. That was a huge, huge request. And so we had many individuals who came back week after week. And so that was really fun. And we got to know people. And they were, as soon as we were closing up in October, asked where we, you know, where they could shop next. And that's one of those benefits of working with Growing Places Indy, is they also have the winter farmers market where they have the SNAP match program there if you come. So the response has been great, and we opened just 2 weeks ago, last Friday, at the Transit Center, and we've already seen a couple of our shoppers from last year and some new individuals as well. So
let me ask this. In terms of are there any plans to take it to other places or to expand the hours that it's available?
We won't expand this year. I would love to expand it, especially if we look at some more mobility hub areas, so where there are many transportation options that are intersecting, where we know that a lot of people are coming or going to. So I think there's a lot of potential to expand it out. This year, we're going to really run this from June until September and continue to collect the evidence that it is serving.
Are there, in terms of expanding, I mean, would there be, will this change, obviously, as Indy's transit options improve, expand themselves?
Absolutely. I think it goes back to sort of knowing where people are traveling to and from and looking at how we're co-locating transportation options, not just, you know, our public transit, but where is Lyft going? Where are their bike lanes? Where are there safe places for people to be carpooling? Sort of looking at that whole suite of mobility options and then layering on services that people may need as well. So food is one of those. And ultimately, that's what I would like to look into in the future. And food and transit would, you know, be one of those elements we would like to add.
Rebecca, of the 900 and some days more than 1,000 young people that you're serving meals to during the course, has that number remained relatively static or has it gone up in recent years?
It remains pretty stable. Of course, it all goes back to capacity and resources. So we try to operate at capacity and get our clubs as full as they can be. So the numbers do represent our capacity and what we're able to do. Of course, with increased capacity, we would serve additional young people and more meals.
Oh, so does that mean that there are kids who could use the meals now who aren't getting them?
Oh, absolutely.
Who come to? How many of those?
All of the young people that come to our program are fed, so okay. they all are receiving meals. But we know that there are so many other young people in our community that aren't accessing our program or other programs that are providing these kind of resources and meals on a daily basis.
Shelley, you know, from the city's perspective, do you see this as a growing problem or does it remain static?
So I would say in our work, we actually distinguish between food access and food security.
Yeah.
So for our work, we would consider Rebecca's service to those young people to be a hunger relief solution, not necessarily a food access solution. So simply, I like to put it to people. So food access is whether or not there's a grocery store in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
And food security is even if the grocery store was on the corner,
if you can't afford it.
You can't afford it.
Or you can't get to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, so that's how we distinguish those two issues in our work.
All right. We got a lot to talk about, and we're going to continue it after the break. We are talking about ways to improve food access here in Central Indiana. My guests are Lauren Day with Indigo, Shelley Settles, Food and Policy Program Coordinator with the City of Indianapolis, and Rebecca James with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, please call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about innovative initiatives to improve food access here in Central Indiana. My guests are Lauren Day with Indigo, Shelley Settles, Food and Policy Program Coordinator with the City of Indianapolis, and Rebecca James with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so in several ways. You could send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or do what a listener named Margaret has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Margaret, you're on the air.
The ninth summer in a row, and you are so right. Even though each summer I get plugged in thanks to your show, I feel like I'm always needing to start at the beginning to figure out how to approach it. So thank you once again, and to your three guests for being so active. My original question was, and as an undergraduate degree in geography from way back in the 70s, the map that shows, this is a fabulous new resource, and wondering how to directly access that. And then I have a second question for the Indigo person related to the Purple Line and some holes that I already working with a couple of landowners there to plug for the possibility of farmers markets with this whole notion of having grown up in Meridian Kessler and still living around the Glendale area, we have way, way, way too many groceries. And then Oldie's side, no groceries. And so anyway, I'll stop. And my question is, how does one access this new map, wonderful map? And two, I'd like to get some information directly from the Indigo person.
Well,
Purple Line.
You came to the right place for both of those, Margaret. Thanks very much for the call and the questions. Take care. Shelley, we'll go with you first. If people want to access the map, is there a place they can do that?
Yeah, so it's available on Pola Center's website, and I can also send you the link, John, so that it's available.
Well, I'll ask you to do two things here. If you know the URL off the top of your head, you do not. Okay.
Yeah, I apologize. It's embedded in their larger project, so they have a variety of
okay, so if they go to the polacenter.org, I presume,
I wouldn't even speculate it.
Pola Center, anyhow, and we can Google Pola Center and we can find that. The other thing I would ask you to do is that when we go off the air, often this conversation continues on our Facebook page. If you just put the link in there
the
comment section,
that
would be
you.
Great. And our listeners then can come back and find that. Okay, the question's about the Purple Line, Lauren.
The Purple Line, certainly.
I think are yours.
So many of us are familiar with the Red Line right now, under construction, set to open in September. The Purple Line is the second slated rapid transit line. And to Margaret's point, it is along our current busiest transit line right now on East 38th Street. And so there is a need and certainly a need for improved transportation in that area. And kind of back to that point about thinking about mobility transfer points and kind of high population, high density areas where improved food access even if it's through a food in transit type model, could make a lot of sense.
How much of this, and I'm going to ask everybody's thoughts on it, because we are moving into a new era now where, you know, I mean, the way people shop, the way they communicate, the, everything is changing rapidly. And in some ways, I think the program you're doing with setting up, in effect, the farm shop at the transit center anticipates that much more. A lot of these experiences are not things that we go out to seek, but somehow we expect them to come to us, or at least that we meet them halfway. Are we just beginning to scratch the surface on the ways that we deal with this problem? Rebecca, you made the mistake of making eye contact first, so I'm going to go with you. Okay.
Yes, I believe fully that opening up additional transit opportunities to our families could very well change the business we do and the business we all do in our community. Just the availability, the accessibility, not just with food, but all the resources and services in the community that our families need to access.
Well, and I'll throw this to Lauren, because you're in the transit business. You know, with this, given this map and all of that, rather than trying to do, and I think Margaret was sort of alluding to this too, that in some places there are way too many grocery stores, and in other places there are no grocery stores. In some ways, the map and the more flexible transportation opportunities now can alleviate part of that by saying, okay, this is where we know we have hungry people or people who don't. Why don't we just bring the food to them? How feasible is that? And if it's feasible, how far away from it are we, Lauren?
It's a very good question. The first point of kind of bringing things to people instead of asking you to go to it, mm-hmm. Is certainly embedded in the food and transit idea. And if with our current transportation system, I mean, we're making investments thanks to the transit referendum, but Indigo has been a lean service, and our mm-hmm. buses were coming every 30 or 60 minutes only, some not running on the weekends at all. So we're saying to our transit riders, and I am one of them, mm-hmm. that, you know, you may live in an area where there either isn't a grocery store or you can't afford the food that is in your area. But so when you get home, you have to take another trip on a bus that may only come every 30 or 60 minutes. And so that becomes a choice that is not feasible, let alone mm-hmm. attractive, right? And so if I recognize too, food in transit is a drop in the, it's a speck, right? Mm-hmm. We're limited. It's only 3 hours. It's only on Fridays right now. But part of it is to prove a model that if we can reduce one of the trips that you need, is that one of the ways that we can combat the issue? So I do think taking it to different locations has some potential, but the other part of your question, and I think you're getting at, is this idea of personal mobility and making sure that all of these different ways that you move about your city are equitably accessible. And so would that help you reach healthy food?
Well, and I'm asking this the question really out of honest to goodness ignorance here. So, you know, and trying to move out the conversation in some ways out of the box. But it occurred to me as Margaret was posing her question, that in some ways, say, the map, if the map tells you there is this area where there are 30, 40, 50 residences where we know people do not have adequate access to food, it might be more cost effective to try to move the food to them than it would be to move representatives from those 30, 40, 50 houses to the food. Shelley, you're making eye contact now, so it's your turn.
Yeah, so I would say this is kind of a wonderful conversation. So in our work, we try to have a two-pronged approach. So both looking at, you know, what Rebecca and Lauren are doing in terms of, you know, bringing the food to the people or bringing the people to the food. You know, it's kind of a two-way street. So in our work, we definitely try to support community partners already engaged in this work. So it's important that we're mindful of many creative options exist across the city, and they've been created by community partners with a stake in their neighborhood. So, for example, we know that the Indiana Black Farmers Co-op and Black Indiana Growers have mobile markets. So they bring the produce to the senior communities, to the, you know, very large apartment communities, knowing that it's difficult. They have mobility issues. So we very much look for our partners like Lawrence Community Gardens, Elephant Gardens, Growing Places Indy, a variety of different community partners to bring that access to the neighborhoods. But we also look to our more conventional partners like Kroger. So actually we have a proposal right now to City County Council in our office, Proposal 258, to actually work with Kroger on this model. They actually have a similar model in Milwaukee that has a full service mobile market that they're able to bring these groceries to the neighborhood. So we know we have, you know, 200,000 residents that are affected by limited food access. So we can have these grassroots options like Lawrence Community Gardens is bringing, but we can also have these more conventional mobile options like Kroger can deliver.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about innovative ways to improve food access here in central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So I've heard now, you know, obviously the idea of setting up produce at the transit center came from an idea in Atlanta. You just referenced, you know, a mobile food mart in Milwaukee. Are there other communities out there, other places, other Boys and Girls Clubs, other transit systems around the country, other cities that are tackling this problem in ways that, that we ought to consider? I'll start with Shelley on that one.
Yeah, so we actually had a few things in our pipeline that we've been exploring with community partners. And so one project that we saw that was happening in Washington, D.C., we just knew we had to have a community conversation here about replicating, was Lyft's grocery access pilot. So I don't know if your listeners are familiar with Southeast Washington, D.C., but the residents of these neighborhoods in Anacostia really struggle with limited food access. And Lyft was able to partner with community organizations to actually transport residents to existing grocery stores with a subsidized ride. So that's something we're working on here in the city of Indianapolis with our local Lyft partners, as well as Mount Carmel and CICF, to really explore how can we can do this in very creative ways. But, you know, this is currently a pilot program in Washington, D.C., so we're gleaning from them as we go. So it's kind of a double pilot.
Well, and it's interesting because, you know, D.C. is considered one of the places that has one of the more sophisticated transit systems, too, in the country. So, you know, I know in some of these conversations we've often looked at creating a mass transit as almost a magic bullet, and it sounds like that's not the case. Yeah, Lauren's shaking her head saying, no, that's not the case. So where are there other places in terms of transit that we should look to and who are dealing with this problem and figure out?
Piggybacking off of Shelley, I think the working with these micro transit providers is what I've seen some pilots doing. So whether it's subsidizing Lyft or a partnership through VIA is another one that some of your listeners may be familiar with, but working with them to provide discounted or subsidized rides to particular users to reach, whether it be food or, you know, participating in the community in other ways. A lot of that is still in a pilot phase. MARTA starting their food access at transit stations was in 2015, and they were one of the first. So I think that hopefully as we see more of these microtransit and mobility partners coming in and seeing their role in all of this, that we may see some more pilots and solutions.
Okay. Rebecca.
Yes. So as an affiliated member with Boys and Girls Clubs of America, we gratefully do have access to so many other professionals throughout the country that are doing really unique work and innovative in their own communities. So one that came to mind was Boys and Girls Clubs of Seattle. They have really amazing community gardens. They have teen kitchen programs where the kids are kind of growing, making, serving their own food. And we do a little bit of that here as well. So you should see some gardens on site at our clubs, and they really become community gardens. Our families are very comfortable in our clubs and in their neighborhoods like we all are. So it brings everyone together around that universal thing being food. Additionally, we have some really great relationships kind of nationwide with Anthem, and we're participating in the Lyft pilot as well, specifically hoping to hone in at our Finish Line Boys and Girls Club located at 38th and Post, which we know is quite a desert right now.
We are talking about innovative ways to improve food access here in central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or do what a listener named Joyce has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Joyce, you're on the air.
Hi, Joyce.
Yes, my name is... Hi, Joyce. Hi, Shelley.
I have a feeling you got a familiar voice. This is someone familiar to the panel. Okay. Okay,
Joyce. I had a question about Proposal 528. I'm a little concerned about that proposal because a lot of the money that's in there is actually going to things that have proven not to be effective. The part where they're sending using Uber or Lyft or one of those to take people to Kroger who left the neighborhood, and you know, it's like it's kind of like one-way busing, taking people out of their neighborhood to and rewarding those that have already abandoned the neighborhood. I have a real problem with money being spent like that, taking people to where the food is and not investing in where it needs to be is a bad investment as far as I'm concerned. And then the other part where they're providing an app so people can find the food, there's already an app for that. It's called Google, you know. So I just see a lot of this is redundant, and, you know, it's kind of an effort that hasn't evidently been well thought out.
Thanks very much for the call, and we'll see if we can get some answers to your questions. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Take care. So I'll start with you, Shelley. We probably ought to explain to people who are not intimate what Proposal 528 is.
Yeah, so our office is the city's Office of Public Health and Safety, and so we get the opportunity to submit proposals to city, county council to request funding for certain projects. And so in our office, we have, you know, constant communication with community partners, and they come up with us with ideas and opportunities, and we try to further those ideas and opportunities. I would say I can talk about both opportunities Joyce mentioned. And, you know, I think people who know me know my background is in research. You know, you don't have to stand in front of a PhD dissertation committee that wants to make you cry and not get used to taking critical feedback. So that's what I'm here for. And I thank you for that, Joyce. So in the conversation about the Lyft project showing that it hasn't been successful in the past, is actually something that we don't know. So that information is not out there. That data is not actually available. So to say it's shown that it does not work, I would love to see that research. I've never seen that research. So we're actually partnering with IUPUI faculty to do the randomization we need to select clients so that we can really study this in a scientifically appropriate way. So rather than just anecdotal information from, you know, blogs on the internet, we really want to do this properly and do the analysis that we need to show whether or not it works. So Joyce, you have my email address. Please let me know that research that you're showing that it doesn't work. And on the topic of
Joyce, if you would, to continue the conversation, put it on the Facebook page, too, so we can see if you got it. Yeah. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Oh, no
you.
Problem. And I would say kind of on the topic of the artificial intelligence we're working on, I think there's a lot of miscommunication. The proposal didn't go into detail because, you know, we were expecting to have a conversation intimately with the city county councilors and the community, but the technology is not Google. So I don't know how many individuals really struggle with what Rebecca talked about, and that is food insecurity. It's a very difficult space to navigate. There's 190 food pantries in the city. SNAP is very difficult application. WIC, TANF have different guidelines. So residents have told us that it's an overwhelming burden for them to struggle struggle with food insecurity, and it's not just a Googleable answer. When I need to know, do I qualify for WIC being pregnant? Is it my child 6 months old? They're very detailed things.
And we can continue this on the other side of the break. We are talking about ways to improve food access here in Central Indiana. My guests are Lauren Day with Indigo, Shelley Suttles, Food and Policy Program Coordinator with the City of Indianapolis, and Rebecca James with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Indianapolis. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today on No Limits about innovative initiatives to improve food access in Central Indiana. My guests are Lauren Day with Indigo, Shelley Suttles, Food and Policy Program Coordinator with the City of Indianapolis, and Rebecca James with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Indianapolis. Before we went to the break, we got a call from a listener named Joyce who was talking about one of the proposals and really sort of the concept of trying to either take people to food rather than trying to, I'm assuming, and if I am mischaracterizing. And I guess I want to explore that a little more because the idea of trying to encourage grocery stores and other places to relocate in areas that are not served or are underserved now is not a new concept either. I mean, as I'm aware of, the late U.S. Senator Robert F. Kennedy sort of pioneered that approach in Bedford-Stuyvesant in New York in the late 60s. During the Reagan era, it was revived with the idea of enterprise zones and using either tax incentives or other inducements. And, you know, at the very least, those attempts were not spectacular successes. Correct, Shelley?
Yeah. So, you know, in our work, so if I just kind of go back to the Lyft pilot very briefly and then just talk about that concept of tax incentives. So we actually, through the Lyft pilot, are not sending people outside of their neighborhood. We're sending them to locally owned business. So Kroger is one of the businesses, but Joyce didn't mention that the other three businesses are minority locally owned businesses. So that's Tienda Morelos, A&I Variety Meats and Produce, and Carniceria Guanajuato. So these are all locally grown, you know, community grocery stores that we are sending to residents to. And these businesses exist in their neighborhood. So when we think about economic development, we want people to patronize these businesses. So we're sending residents to those businesses. But also on the other end, when we talk about tax incentives and city funding brick and mortar retail grocery store, I'm very mindful of the conversation around Cub Foods in the 90s in Avondale Meadows. And that Cub Foods closing, you know, I spent first few months of this job really walking the neighborhoods, talking to residents, and it was very traumatic to the residents to have that grocery store close, and that was financed by all of, you know, those tax incentives. And I talked to the people that were involved in that project, and they are very smart and very passionate and had the best intentions, but it just wasn't what was necessary at that time. So that's why we're working on these creative solutions. So we do still have CDBG, so Community Development Block Grant Funding, which we've used to help Indigo and Growing Places Indy bring the food in transit model to light. But we also use those CDBD dollars to open Flanner House's Cleo's Bodega. And so I just want to give a shout out to them because they have their grand opening today. And so this is bringing that small footprint, community-based retail grocery store back into the neighborhood of 25th and MLK.
Lauren, I didn't know if you wanted to, you'd mentioned during the break. Okay. We are talking about really ways to battle food availability and food access, food insecurity here in Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at wfyi. Or do what John has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. John, you're on the air.
Hi. My question would be, what are they doing to address the possibilities of crime, shoplifting? You know, if a store is making money, they're not going to leave an area. If they're losing money, that's why they're leaving. So, you know, my suspicion on part of it would be because they're in impoverished neighborhoods where the deserts are at, there's possibly high levels of shoplifting, and so the stores are losing money, and that's why they're giving up.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Shelley.
Yeah, John, that is an excellent point. I've talked to retail grocers in the city, and they have said, you know, due to the opioid crisis, they are getting, you know, quote unquote, cleaned out. So, you know, there's very significant organized retail theft of grocery product that is sold on the black market. And that is very, you know, it's very significant in its quantity and its impact to the bottom line of being able to keep that grocery store open. So I try to remind residents, also just don't think about product being stolen from the store, but also shopping carts. Shopping carts can be $400 to $500. So if you see shopping carts across your community, that means the grocery store just lost that $400 or $500. And so we have to come together as a community, patronize these businesses, but also be respectful of them and ask that they stay in our neighborhoods.
I'm going to take it, Lauren, another approach on this. I mean, we have thought of transit, at least in years past, primarily of ways of getting people to jobs or all of that. It would strike me in listening to this conversation that the approach to planning transit routes and creating a transit system now is becoming much more multifaceted and complicated. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So at Indigo, we say access to opportunity, whatever that may mean, opportunity to buy fresh food, opportunity to receive job training, to see your friends and family, to worship, whatever it may be. So when we're looking at where do we build and invest in transit, we're looking at these same maps, right? Where is the density of employment? Where is the density of residents? Where's the activity happening? And doing our best with those limited resources to make it as accessible as possible to and from and within those areas. So absolutely, it is multifaceted, and food is certainly one of those priorities.
Rebecca, I would think the same thing. I mean, you know, in many ways, the Boys and Girls Clubs are still, you know, institutions, and there's still a, you know, a transportation problem often for these kids. Or, you know, the Boys and Girls Clubs looking at a, you know, you talked about there are a lot of kids out there who would need this help, would need food, all of that. Are there places or ways that you could conceive of where some of the things that the Boys and Girls Clubs offer can be taken to the kids rather than having the kids come to the Boys and Girls Club?
Yeah, that's a great question, and a model that's been tried and practiced in several Boys and Girls Club communities. We are very traditionally facility-based and known for our clubhouses, but we're also very intentional about where we put those clubhouses so that we are fully integrated within a community that has great need. So in most of the communities we serve, our young people and our families are coming to us on foot. However, there can be a lot of barriers and potential dangerous situations by being a pedestrian, a walking pedestrian. So transportation is a barrier. We do have two full-size buses in our fleet and some mini buses, and we try to collaborate and coordinate with schools to get our kids to and from safely. But I would say, in addition to your question, to really answer, a great example would be our school-based operations. So we have five programs that are actually located within the confines of a school. So we're right where the kids are in the morning, and they have a seamless transition to us in the afternoon and then a way to get home in the evening.
We are talking about ways to improve food access here in Indianapolis and central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Marley has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Marley, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah. I was just listening to this conversation while on the way to drop off produce at a senior community in Lawrence. So I thought I would call in and share a resource that I have. I work for Oak Street Health. We're primarily a primary care doctor's office for adults on Medicare, but we also do a lot of work in the community to just keep people happy and healthy and One of the biggest things we do is set up pop-up produce stands at senior living communities. And so that's what I'm doing today, is bringing fresh produce to a senior living facility. And also just wanted to share that if there are any communities out there that are in need of that, that do are connected to seniors, we would love to set something up with you. And I can always share that my email on the Facebook page, or look up Oak Street Health. We have multiple facilities around the community in the Indianapolis area, and just thought I'd throw that out there as another resource to get fresh produce to people.
And I will encourage you to share that information on the Facebook page. That would be very helpful, Marley.
And thank you for that service to City. Thank
Yes,
you.
Thank you. Thanks much for the call.
Thank you for having this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Certainly. Certainly. How much of this, I mean, so far we're talking about sort of official institutional approaches to dealing with this problem. But that's doesn't sound like that's been sanctioned by anyone other than somebody decided it's a good way to try to help people. You know, how many of those solutions are we aware of in the community, Shelley?
So the community-based solutions?
Yeah, well, and also just a pure, almost individual initiative there.
Yeah, so actually kind of we have a strong connection in the city of Indianapolis with the Indy Food Council and the Indy Hunger Network, if we include the hunger relief space. So we actually have a tab on the Indy Food Council website, which is Community Map. So you can go and include your community food project in this community map and get yourselves on the map. So we definitely encourage Oak Street to go to indyfoodcouncil.org and to the community map and to add your project to that. So we know residents reach out to us all the time for resources that, you know, are not as easily accessible on Google as one may think. Oftentimes people aren't using the general taxonomy that hits the algorithm for Google. So we really want to put that in one space to make it easily accessible for residents.
And the inverse of that is that that's a place that people can go and say, okay, I live in this area and these are resources that might be available in this area for me.
Definitely. And I also think...
And you can give the URL if you want to.
Okay. Yeah. So that's indyfoodcouncil.org.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We are talking about ways to improve food access here in central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Mike has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Mike, you're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. And my compliments to your guests that are making such an impact in food deserts. My question centers around the fact that in urban areas, my daughter lived in New York and for years had her food delivered by Fresh Direct. Isn't building on the evolution of grocery delivery and grocery pickup by the big chains something that for a fairly small investment could subsidize or supplement delivery of packages of food and food orders in a food desert from surrounding outlets? And it just seems that there's some infrastructure that it would take one step more, and without building new stores and a tremendous amount of capital investment, could just subsidize and incent the services that deliver food now to extend their reach.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Mike. I'm going to throw that one first to Lauren and just ask, you know, are there any places where in this country or around the world where they're using, in effect, transit systems or existing, you know, to do that, to deliver food directly to consumers?
I can't think of a specific example off the top of my head. And Mike, while you were asking your question, I was thinking Shelley may be aware of some of those food delivery services that offer special pricing based on income, because there is certainly not one answer that will solve all this. So I think many of the solutions that we've talked about today, including the Lyft, is one of part of that whole. But one of the things that I was recently was talking about at a conference is how we're better thinking about our streets, and so making them safer for people to walk on and making getting to whatever the neighborhood resource is more accessible. And that includes these pickup drop-off zones. So delivery is becoming, as we know, more and more of a way that people are getting things. And the more space that we take up with delivery vehicles, those could be used, for instance, you know, we're thinking about how do we work with community centers who have a vehicle that they may not be using during the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. And how could that maybe be a delivery vehicle for a Kroger pickup? And so, you know, not adding more cars to our street, knowing that delivery is an option, but thinking about how we can better use that space to meet all the needs of everybody. So,
okay. And Shelley, I'll let you take the bulk of Mike's question.
So I would say to answer Mike's question, basically the country is in a holding pattern right now, and we're waiting on USDA to complete a pilot which would allow retail grocers to use SNAP or EBT or food stamps online. So we know, you know, if you're middle income or upper, you can freely shop on Amazon, Kroger, ClickList, Shipt, you know, Instacart, whatever you need can be delivered to your door in regards to groceries. But really, we're concerned about low-income households and them having the same opportunities. So we wait for USDA to complete the pilot. Most likely, they will give clearance to allow us to use EBT online, and that will really be a game changer for food delivery.
We are talking about food access here in Central Indiana. Tracy, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having this conversation today.
Certainly. We're getting a little close on time, so I'm going to ask you to be quick.
Okay. In a nutshell, today I'm fighting for my life and food insecurity here in the great state of Indiana because I'm getting tossed around in a free-for-all pass the buck between Medicaid, the enteral supply company, and a fool of a doctor. I've dropped 16 outfit sizes in a year and a half, which is disturbing to me. I've got medical experience. I'm very articulate in what my symptoms are. I've been getting a lack of basic medical care, basic housing, and food literally dropped $55 for this month from SNAP benefits because I am being, quote, penalized because I do not meet the criteria of having a home anymore. By the way, I called the Medicaid office and explained to them I could show proof in my receipts that my bills have increased substantially on the same disability and SSI income, while in fact I have no place to live. I'm being penalized from the government for it. They took $55 out of $70 of my food away in 1 month. And now I'm being refused access to the enteral drinks, which are supposed to help supplement, because that's basically looking like my only source of nutrition, and now the orders are wrong. This is all literally happening today. I spent time on the phone until I threw the phone and nearly broke it. This is a basic human right, and it's so disturbing to me to know that there are people literally suffering a long, merciless, slow, sad, and humiliating death because we live in the great state.
Tracy,
and we don't have a basic need getting met.
No, and I apologize for having to cut in. We are running right up on the end of the program. What I'm going to try to do is figure out a way, if you could call back when we are off the air and give us your contact information, I will put Shelley in touch with you.
But okay. I also want to let everyone know in this situation, because I thank you, Tracy, for giving us this information, but you can contact Indiana Legal Services and they can help you with some of this. So for anyone calling in this case.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Lauren Day, Shelley Suttles, and Rebecca James, for what has been an important conversation. And our, as usual, our great listeners. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.